Kia ora, tēnā koutou, nō mai, haere mai. Hello everyone, welcome to the Walking the Shadowlands podcast. Join me as we take a walk into the realms of the unexplained, of the paranormal, of things that go bump in the night and haunt your dreams.
Your hosts,
I'm Marianne. Thanks so much for joining me today, tonight, whatever time it is, wherever you live in this beautiful world of ours. Sit back and relax. Let me be your guide as we walk into the Shadowlands together and see what awaits us there. Welcome to another episode of Walking the Shadowlands, where we look deeply into the realms of the unknown with fascinating guests and extraordinary stories. Today, we're honoured to have with us Robert Zelaz, a distinguished former US Air Force officer and a key figure in the investigation of UFO phenomena. Robert's journey began with 7 years of active duty following his graduation from the Air Force Academy. Assigned as a missile launch officer, he held control over 10 nuclear missiles, known as the Minuteman series, stationed at various launch facilities. His role was pivotal, his responsibilities immense. But yet, nothing could prepare him for the events that would unfold during his time in that role. Robert experienced encounters that defied all conventional explanation as he fulfilled his duties deep in the underground confines of launch control facilities. He encountered phenomena that challenged his understanding of reality and left an indelible mark on his life. But Robert's journey doesn't end there. Beyond his military service, he has bravely come forward to share his personal experiences with encounters that extend beyond our earthly bounds. His first-hand accounts of extraterrestrial contact shed light on the complexities of our universe and the mysteries that perhaps lay beyond our current comprehension. But the question as always is, are you willing to walk into this part of the Shadowlands to explore mysteries of the cosmos and perhaps uncover truths that may forever alter our understanding of what reality is? Then, let's begin. Robert Zelaz is a graduate of the US Air Force Academy. He served 7 years on active duty. He worked as a weapons controller, carried target drones, commanded intercontinental ballistic missiles as a launch officer, and worked as an Air Force missile propulsion engineer on the Titan III program. From 1971 to 1973, he worked as a safety and reliability engineer for Martin Marietta Aerospace and Rockwell International on space shuttle design proposals. From 1979 until his retirement in 1995, he worked for the Federal Aviation Administration. In 1994, he bravely began speaking out about his military encounters with the USA that shut down these intercontinental ballistic missiles, despite his non-disclosure agreement with the military that is still actively in force. In 2022, he testified at the Brazilian Senate public hearing on UFOs. This was only one of the many times he has spoken of his military UFO encounter. He's also a published author, having 3 books, The Faded Giant, Unidentified the UFO Phenomenon, and UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle, which are all available from his website. I'd like to welcome my guest, Robert Zelaz. Welcome to my special guest, Robert Salas. Maybe you could start by sharing a brief overview of your background and your role in the Air Force during the time of the UFO incident you experienced.
Yeah, I spent 7 years active duty after graduating from the Air Force Academy. And one of my assignments was as a missile launch officer. So in that capacity, I was on a two-man crew who would go out to what we called a launch control facility. We had control of 10 nuclear missiles. In this case, they're called the Minuteman I missile at that time. So I arrived at Malmstrom Air Force Base the next and teamed with a man named Fred Mywald, who later retired as a full colonel. At any rate, the incident occurred on March 24th, 1967. And we were at what's called Oscar Flight. It's just simply O Flight or Oscar Flight. We were about 100 miles to the east of Great Falls, Montana. I don't know if your guests know, right at the Canadian border, right?
Oh, that's right.
Right up north there in about the center of the country of the U.S. And at any rate, we were at a location called Oscar Flight. And the location is called a launch control facility, 60 feet underground. We had a hardened capsule. There were just two of us down underground. We had all the controls for the missiles there and no controls upstairs. We had a six-man team of guards, security guards, and we were locked in for 24 hours.
Wow.
Ready to launch missiles or just monitor the activities that were going on. And of course, this was during the Cold War era. We were already fighting in Vietnam. So it was, you know, a tense situation worldwide. Sometime in the evening, my commander was taking a rest break and I was in charge of the facility. I get a call from my topside guard. He's telling me that they're seeing lights in the sky flying back and forth and making no noise, no engine noise. He says they're going very fast, stopping in midair and reversing course, making 90-degree turns, and very unusual, and wanted just to inform me of this. I didn't know what to think of it. I hadn't really thought about UFOs much, even though there were reports in the newspapers about them in the local town of Great Falls. But I thanked him, hung up, and then 5 minutes later, he calls back, and this time he's very frightened. He's clearly frightened. He's screaming into the phone, shouting, making no sense. And then I try to calm him down, and then he tells me that there's a red-orange light, large object, very bright light pulsating, and it's hovering just above the front gate area of our facility. He wanted me to tell him what to do next. He had the guards out there with their weapons drawn. I told him, this time I took him very seriously, and because it sounded like we were under some sort of a potential attack. I told him to make sure nothing enters the secure area, the fenced area, and they hung up. One of the guards was injured, not from the object. I can explain that later, Then I went to tell my commander about the phone calls, and all of a sudden the missiles started going or disabled. They just went from a green status or a go status to a no-go status. And so while this object was up there, all 10 of our nuclear missiles were disabled.
Wow.
We had also incursion lights or possibility of something intruding where the missiles were actually located about a mile or so in a kind of a ring around the central hub of the launch control facility. The actual missiles were about a mile or two or three away. We sent guards out there to two of the sites where we got this incursion lights, and they saw UFOs again. So they reported them again. This is all confirmed by my commander later in a tape recording I have of him talking about this in 1996. At any rate, he makes the call to the command post at Malmstrom Air Force Base at Great Falls, about 100 miles away, and then it's just the call reporting the incident. He turns to me and says the same thing happened at another flight. And I thought it was that evening, but it turns out later I found out that it was 8 days earlier. Within 8 days, we lost 20 nuclear missiles. By lost, I mean they were disabled. They were not damaged in any way. They were simply, I can tell you what happened. Basically, this object sent a signal through 60 feet of earth and concrete, and all these shielded cables that we had to each of the missiles separately to upset the guidance system. We had an inertial guidance system, which required orienting the missile toward the target properly, you know, and it just upset that guidance. So the missile couldn't launch, otherwise it wouldn't have an accurate way of getting to the target. So that happened. Within the span of 8 days, we lost 20 of them to these UFOs.
That must have been absolutely terrifying. How old were you when this happened?
How old? Well, let's see. I was about 27.
Yeah, that's pretty young.
26.
That orange light that you talked about, that sounds very similar to what was seen in the Rendlesham Forest incident.
Yes.
Very, very similar. And they also had nuclear weapons on their base, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Very interesting. When you talk about incursion lights, do you mean that the light actually went inside the missile chamber?
What I meant was we had a status board, and each missile, our launch facility, had a series of lights associated with it.
Right.
So the top showed, the top light showed a normally green or a go status of the missile.
Right.
But we also had a couple of indicator lights that would show if something or someone tried to intrude the launch facility area. That's what I meant by incursion.
Right.
Those are the indicators we got at two of the sites, and I had to send guards out there to check that out.
Wow. That must have been pretty terrifying for you guys, especially given
it was the
world situation, because you wouldn't have known what was going on. Did these UFOs that shut down the nuclear warhead or the missiles, did they permanently disable them? Were you able to bring them back online afterwards?
Yes, we were able to bring them back online relatively quickly. And like I said, there was no damage to any of the equipment, no damage at all, really. They were back online within 24 hours.
Gosh. So what happened? I imagine, I'm just picturing in my mind the scenario of you guys down in your bunker. You must have been completely stressed, all of you, thinking, what the heck's going on? What do we do? Scrambling to find, to source what was going on exactly. What happened once these missiles were shut down? Did you notify the chain of command, or what exactly happened from there?
Yeah, that's exactly what I described. My commander called the command post to report the incident.
Oh, right. Sorry.
And he reported the entire thing. And then we were relieved the next morning. I immediately went upstairs and talked to the security guard, and he repeated that this was a very bright, so bright he had a hard time looking into the object, but he could discern that there was a form, elliptical-shaped form inside the light. But other than that, he couldn't describe it much because of the brightness of the light that surrounded it. And this is also typical of other sightings. There seems to be, at times, a very bright light around the object, or it's obscured by some ionized gas of some sort.
Yes, it does. Mm.
At any rate, we were ordered to report to our squadron commander's office, and there they had us sign non-disclosure statements, never to talk about this again. And so we complied with that until 1994.
Okay, first off, let's go to the airman that was on the ground that she saw it. I imagine he was pretty traumatized by the experience, by the sounds of it, and who wouldn't be? Did he have any physical effects from his encounter?
Well, see, that's the problem. Well, I know he was ordered not to talk to me even when I went back, and I was his commanding officer. So I had to really brace him, I guess, and order him to discuss what he saw again. But then the next morning, after I had gone home, house in town, and I got a call the next morning from the guards, and they wanted to speak with me about what they had seen because they were still shaken, obviously, and I had to tell them I couldn't see them. I couldn't talk to them because I was ordered never to talk to anyone, not even anyone in the Air Force about it.
Wow. That's really... And so here you have these traumatized people, yourself included, and you can't discuss it with anybody. And of course, obviously, the Air Force didn't provide you with any sort of counseling or support to help you come to terms with that. They just left you.
No, that's right. This was a traumatic incident, especially for them. Not so much for me. I didn't really see the object. Remember, I was underground.
Yeah.
But they did, very close range. And I'm sure they were traumatized.
Oh, doubtless. Have you, since then, and since you came public, and by the way, I would like to thank you for your bravery in doing that, because I know that you took your vows to the military very seriously. And so it took some steel balls, for want of a better word, to come out and actually be public about it.
Well, let me just explain a little more. In 1994, and again, that was, I guess, 27 years had passed, and I was in a bookstore and picked up a book called Above Top Secret by Timothy Good.
Right.
I don't know if you've ever heard of Timothy Good.
Yes, I have, and the book.
Mm. And I pick up that book, and I happened to turn to page 301 of that book, and that was the only page that I could have read that had this story. But it said UFOs were shut down at a missile site in Montana at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1966 and 67. Well, I was elated. I thought that was my incident and thought the Air Force might have declassified it. And so I asked the local MUFON chapter for an investigator, Mutual UFO Network, and asked him to send a Freedom of Information Act request. In other words, requesting information about this particular incident where missiles were shut down during, well, for unusual reason. I just said, don't mention UFOs, just say that, you know, what happened on that date in this area. And Air Force wrote back, and apparently the person that wrote back didn't realize it was a UFO event. But they said that they had documents, and they were going to declassify them now that I requested them. And so essentially they declassified the Echo flight incident. Now, Echo was not the flight that I was, but I didn't realize it at the time. At the time I got these documents declassifying the Echo incident, I thought that was my incident. Mm. And since it was declassified by the Air Force, I decided to go public and say, yeah, I was there and UFOs were seen overhead during the incident. So that's why I went public initially. And it wasn't until 2 years later, after I started contacting more witnesses and more people or trying to locate my commander. I didn't even remember his name because, again, 27 years.
Right.
A lot of water under the bridge. You know, you have children, you get married, all kinds of things happen in your life.
Right.
And my commander at the time, well, when I finally got a hold of him in 1996, he said, you know, we weren't at Echo Flight. We were at Oscar Flight, which is a different location. And I said, oh, my goodness, I've been talking about this publicly. And we had been ordered or we signed these non-disclosure statements.
My goodness.
I decided on my own, really. Without asking permission from anyone, I decided since these incidents were so similar, the Air Force declassified the one, I'm just going to keep speaking about this publicly. Since I've been speaking about it for 2 years already, I've given interviews on radio and television and newspaper reports and what have you. I decided I'd keep speaking about it. And so I did. I told everybody, you know, I was, and I still tell people, including you, that technically I'm in violation of that non-disclosure agreement, which is basically that I would not talk about this ever again. I'm in violation of that agreement. But in the 30 or so years I've been speaking publicly about this, nobody in the U.S. government or the Air Force has come to me and said, stop talking about it. And so I haven't. I have no qualms about continuing to speak about it.
Wow, that's really interesting. And yet with other incidents, they shut the witnesses down. I've heard.
Well, they did initially, yeah. Yeah. And then to quite echo, SOCO commander and ZEPI commander, and I have their testimony. Let me suggest to your audience that you go to my website, spiralgalaxy.org. If you go to my website, you'll see all the evidence, basically most of the evidence I have supporting the facts of these two incidents, including audio testimony from myself, my commander, the deputy commander at Echo Flight, and a written correspondence from his commander, all supporting facts that 20 missiles were disabled during UFO encounters in 1967.
And I saw that on your website, and I was really impressed with that, that it's all out there publicly for anybody to see. So listeners, if you didn't catch Robert's website address, don't worry. If you visit this episode's page on the podcast website, www.walkingtheshadowlands.com, there will be links to Robert's website there, so you can access that and also any of the three books that Robert's written. I remember you came to my attention during the press club conference. Is that what it's called? The one there?
The National Press Club?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I've given, which year?
Oh, that was the one with Stephen Greer.
Oh, that was 2001. And then I've been on other press conferences, many others. The latest one was in 2021, October. And I've got that complete video on my website of that press conference. That's the latest one, where I go over other incidents involving UFOs and nuclear weapons. That's about a two-hour video, so I don't take a little time to go through it.
I'm going to have to sit and watch that when we finish this. I was so impressed with, my mind's going all over. I've got 101 questions in my mind, Robert, and it's trying to formulate the right ones. During these incidents, I assume they happened really quickly. There was no form of communication from any of these UFOs or was you guys trying to communicate with these, whomever they were?
Well, I'll tell you honestly, after I hung up the phone, after that second call with my security guard, I turned over just to look at my status board. I had the feeling, and it could have been a communication, but I had the feeling they were going to do something with my missiles. It was just a feeling. Mm. Even though they had no controls upstairs, we had all the controls for the missiles downstairs. So that could have been a communication. Now, of course, I've had other experiences. And I don't know if you've read my book, either of my books.
I'm sorry, I haven't had a chance to, because Ceciani contacted me about you like a few days ago, so I haven't had a chance to read it, but I actually intend to. Usually before I interview people, I read their books so I can have an informed conversation.
Yeah, well, I have a close encounter, an abduction experience, if you want to hear about that.
Love to hear about that, Robert, absolutely. And actually, that was going to be a question that I was coming into, so there you go.
Okay, so this happened in 1985. And again, this is described in my book, Unidentified UFO Phenomenon. But 1985, I had not gone public yet. I was living in Manhattan Beach, California, in a particular house that I recall. And sometime in the evening, I had my wife and two small children at the time in the house. And sometime in the evening, I wake up and I see a blue light emanating from the living room. And I wake my wife up, I ask her if she sees the blue light. We don't have any blue lights in our living room. And she says, yes. I say, well, I'm going to try to get up and investigate because there might be a burglar in the house. And of course, we had two small children. So I attempt to get out of the bed and I can't move. I'm paralyzed, absolutely paralyzed. And I remember struggling, really struggling hard to get my mobility back. And I couldn't. I turned to my wife for help, and now she's unconscious. My wife is unconscious. Even though we had this situation, the next thing I recall, there is a figure in the doorway of our bedroom. It's a hooded figure. And then I'm aware of other little people, we'll call them. They seem like children to me in the room. And then I'm lifted off the bed and kind of guided towards the window of the bedroom. The window had been locked. I remember locking it. I didn't think they knew how to unlock it. They seemed like small children to me.
Right.
And they took me right through the window. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that's what happened. They took me right through the window without opening it. And the next thing I know, I'm aboard the craft, lying on a metal type bed. It wasn't a bed. It was more like a table.
Examination table, right.
Examination table, yeah. And I'm being shown a long needle. And being holds the needle right in front of my eyes. And it was holding it with two very long bony fingers. Very long bony fingers. They put it right in front of my eyes. And they communicate with me telepathically that they're going to insert this in my groin area and that it's not going to hurt. Well, they started the procedure and it hurt like hell. I mean, it was really very, very painful. It's the worst pain I've ever felt. And I communicated that to them, obviously, somehow, probably with screaming. But as I did, the pain went away instantly. So they completed the procedure, which was probably to remove sperm. And next thing, I'm sitting up on the table and two small beings on either side, kind of like an escort. They escort me over to the side of the ship. It was kind of a molded bench. I'm sitting there for a little while and then probably recovering. But then they take me over to another cubicle. We're floating all this time. We're not walking. We're floating. Yeah. I'm taken over to another cubicle and another one of the beings. This time he's got a white smock on. Looks like a doctor's smock, or maybe it was just my imagination. But he turns me around and then he pokes two digits or fingers down my spine like this.
Right. This,
right down my spine. I don't know why, but then he turns me back over to the other two and we go through this curved tunnel. And at the end of the tunnel is a white, bright light. Poof, I'm back in my bed. The next morning, of course, I didn't remember any of that. Mm-hmm. Neither did my wife. We didn't speak of it. I didn't remember. We didn't speak of it. 2008, so that's what, 23 years later, I'm at Carrick-on-Shannon, Ireland. I'm sitting in a UFO conference. My wife and I was invited to speak there, and there was a abductee or experiencer giving her talk, and then she says, and then a blue light filled my bedroom. And I remember my wife and I hadn't talked about this at all.
Yeah.
And I turned to my wife and I said, do you remember a blue light in our living room many, many years ago? She said, yes. So that was confirmation.
Yeah. And you remember so much detail from your experience. And obviously it came back to you later.
This was the result of four hypnotherapy regressions.
Gotcha.
And the first regression session I had was that very evening. With someone you might know, I'm trying to remember her name. She's Australian.
Oh, well, I'll think of it.
I think I know who you're talking about. I've heard Susie Ann, the Australian lady who does the UFO research in Australia, talking about her, how they referred people to her. Yeah, but I don't know her name, but I know who you mean. I've heard of her before.
I had a session with her that evening and started to recover some of those memories, but then I had three more sessions after that to recall what I've told you.
Mm.
There's probably more to recall. I haven't had any more sessions. There's probably more things that I have just forgotten.
Oh, I'm sure there are. Can I ask you a few questions about your experience, if that's okay with you?
Sure.
When you talked about the wall curving inside the ship, I actually recall seeing that numerous times myself. And the bright white light that seems to permeate everything, but it's not hard on your eyes. It just brought back the memories for me. In the middle of all of this, was there anything else that you observed about the areas that you were in at that particular time?
Well, all I can tell you is there seemed to be cubicles where there were other, like little office areas. One of the cubicles was translucent or transparent. I don't know if it was glass around it or what, but I could see like this being in a white smock inside the cubicle. The bench, like I said, was molded into the side of the craft, it seemed to me. Other than that, I don't recall, other than the fact that after this occurred, actually, approximately two weeks after this occurred in 1985, I was out in my garden and stopped for some reason, held my head up and thought, you know, I've been out in space. I've seen the blackness of space and the stars. So that's why I say I think I probably was able to see out somehow and see what space looked like without the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere.
Interesting. To me, it feels to me, Robert, from my own knowing of having been an experience in my entire life, that more happened when those missiles were shut down than you're aware of. And I suspect you have had some sort of ongoing experience with these beings.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I've been visited many times here in my home. My wife has been visited. And in fact, when I was growing up, I know I had at least one sighting when I was about 10 years old.
There you go. That makes sense.
Walking with my father in the evening, we saw a bright light that was not a star, and it was in the sky. And we see that. But yeah. And then my mother, before I was even born, and similar to, you probably read Susie's book.
Yes.
And similar to her experience, but not similar, but something like that. My mother, when she was about 12 years old, she was spending the night with some friends, cousins at her home, at their home. And they were sleeping, you know, on the floor in one of these rooms. And sometime in the evening, they're all startled when a very tall white woman, you know, I'm Hispanic, and all my cousins were Hispanic, dark-skinned, a little darker-skinned, and this white woman walks into the room, and nobody knows who she is. This is in Chandler, Arizona, and at the time, that was 1920, and the houses, of course, weren't that close to each other. There was a lot of room between homes, not like it is now, but she walks into the room, a tall white woman, and smiles at my mother, who's only 12, and then disappears. So walks away or disappears, she said. And the next evening, same situation, but they're in this, sleeping all in this room. And then my mother wakes up when what she calls a midget was whispering in her ear in a language she didn't understand. She understood both English and Spanish, but that's what woke her up. And she looks at this midget and screams. Everybody else wakes up and they see this midget scurry off or run away. I think that was a experience, you know, probably she was contacted there.
I was wondering if actually prior to the incident that you had actually been an experiencer, simply because it's been my experience and my knowing that these beings tend to follow families for generations.
Yeah. I think that's true.
That makes absolute sense to me that you would be an go ahead.
I just want to add, during my first regression with, I think her name is Mary. Is it Mary? Yeah. Anyway, that was that evening in 2008. One of the things I said to her was that these beings that had taken me in 1985 were the same group that had shut down my missiles.
Yes.
And that was communicated to me during the incident.
That's exactly what I felt. I felt that they were the same beings. Can you now, seeing the hooded figure, that's not the first time I've heard of experiences seeing a hooded figure. I actually interviewed a Canadian chap, I think it was in my second season, who had experiences with hooded figures.
Wait a minute. Mary Rodwell. She's the Australian lady who gave me that first hypnotic regression. Yes, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, that's absolutely fine. I was just saying that I interviewed a Canadian chap in my second season of the podcast, and he had been an experiencer his entire life, and he saw these hooded beings you did. Tall hooded beings. So you never saw that particular being's features, just his fingers.
Exactly. I never saw his face or its face. However, the other thing that came out during that first regression is that I had the feeling these were reptilian in nature.
Okay.
And especially the large one that operated on me or did something to me with that needle.
Right.
Now, I'm going to shock you even more. I don't know if I can shock you.
Might shock my listeners.
Let's go to 2000. When a friend of mine calls me and says, hey Bob, have you heard about the mummies of Nazca, Peru?
Right.
And I said, no. Well, you got to go with me. I'm going to go to Peru to listen to some scientists explain what they've found about these so-called mummies of Peru that were discovered about 2015, I think, in the Nazca Plain. And so I said, no, I don't know. You know, there's been so many of these false, things about creatures. He said, well, go to the website. There's a website called The Alien Project. And so I went to that website, and one of the discoveries was they had found detached hands.
Right.
Creatures. Have you been to that website?
No, I haven't, but I did follow for a while that they were doing these scientific tests on these bodies.
Yeah. I see these hands, and there are the long, bony fingers that I saw during my...
Right.
Same thing I remember. Long. Now, by long, I mean, we have 1, 2, 3 segments to our fingers.
Yeah.
He's had 5.
Wow.
5 segments like this to their fingers. Very long fingers. 3 fingers. They're all tridactyls.
Yes.
And so I called my friend back and said, when are you leaving? I'm going with you. Even without talking to my wife first, who controls the purse, the family purse. And so I had to talk her into it. We almost got divorced over that. Anyway, she agreed. And so I fly off to Cusco, Peru. And I'm glad I did. I was able to actually talk to the people who had the objects in their possession, and they allowed me to go see these detached hands, skulls, and little bodies, tridactyls. They had reptilian skin, and I was able to hold the hand, one of the detached hands, which is about, this long, and that was an experience. But I'm convinced that those were the kinds of creatures that I encountered during my abduction.
Right. So the smaller creatures that you saw, would they be what would pass as the typical gray that people yes. talk about? Right.
Can I do something? I'm going to turn my computer around. Let's see. I don't know if I can turn the camera, but anyway, I'll turn it around. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. This is a replica of one of the, what I call mummies of Peru.
Right.
You see that?
Yeah, yeah. Very long, long arms.
And you notice there's a copper plate crossing the chest area. Yeah.
Yes, I saw that.
That's actually embedded into the being, the mummy. And then in the hands themselves, there's a circular metal plate. And we don't know what the purpose of that is. It's up to speculation. But for some reason, they had these, and they have some on the joints. They have some kind of metallic things on the joints, some of them. But amazing stuff.
I have heard, and I don't know it's a reality of this, that some of the smaller gray species, of course, there's many species, are actually like robots. They were like drone workers.
Yes. Organic, but still robotic in nature, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And that would explain the metal bits in the body.
Yeah, right.
Because they don't seem to have, they sort of seem to have a hive mind.
I'm sorry?
They seem to have a hive mind in that these smaller ones, they just follow orders. They don't initiate stuff of their own accord.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've heard that.
Yeah.
In fact, Whitley Strieber says the same kind of thing. I don't know if you know Whitley Strieber.
Yes, I've.
He talks about encountering the beings. They reminded him of bees almost, like they were just acting robotically as a group, and they had a kind of a one mind group.
Very interesting, isn't it? How has knowing that you've been an experiencer left you feeling?
How what now?
Sorry, how does knowing that you're an experiencer, that you've been on ships, that you've had medical procedures done to you, how does that leave you feeling in regards, just in regards to your earlier experience in the
Everest? Well, I don't ascribe any particular emotion to that. I'm not angry about it per se. I'd just like to know why, what they're up to. And in fact, I'm thinking about writing another book as to their agenda. What are they up to, and what is their purpose here with us?
Ah, that would be a very interesting book. Now, Susie told me that your book, UAPs and the Nuclear Puzzle, Susie told me that you've added an addendum to that recently. Is that correct?
I revised the last book called Unidentified UFO Phenomena. I revised that extensively, pretty much each chapter, to bring it up to date.
Right.
Because that book was written in 2013. And the result of that effort is my new book, UAP and the Nuclear Puzzle.
Right. Robert, in all this time that you've been speaking out publicly, have you had any backlash or negative experiences from, let's say, undisclosed alphabet agencies trying to stop you from speaking out?
Well, I haven't had any negative experiences per se. However, starting in 1969 and going through 1971, the cabal, I'll just mention what I call the cabal. It's an international group, a secret, highly secretive group.
Right.
Has agents in many countries that are maybe exchanging information about what they've uncovered from recovery of bodies and craft, including, of course, the U.S. government. They have tried to recruit me from time to time. And that's typical, I think, of what they do with with witnesses. They try to read them in a little bit and get them to work for them under very highly classified or secret circumstances. And I've resisted that every time because I knew what they were trying to do.
Right.
And so I could continue to speak out publicly about what I know.
Because they can put a lot of pressure on people. And it's not particularly on you, but they will threaten those you love.
Yes. Yeah, they'll use all sorts of techniques like threats. Mm. Threats of violence and threats of making you out to be insane or unstable or whatever, what have you. Yeah, I think that goes on. I think that's part of the process of keeping these secrets by this cabal.
Exactly. 100% agree. So can I have your take on these latest events happening? Disclosure to your Congress? With these people speaking to your Congress members?
Yes, that was fairly recent. Three ex-military spoke directly to Congress in an open hearing. It was televised, and most Americans saw it, or if they were interested, they could see it. And there were some interesting things that came out of that, and that was historic, I think.
Very historic.
Historic and beneficial towards the effort of disclosure. Things that came out were, especially by Commander Fravor, a Navy commander who was part of the incident called the Tic Tac incident.
Yeah.
But he explained that what that object did that he encountered could not have been done by any aircraft that the U.S. has or any other country for that matter. Mm. Essentially, he confirmed that these objects are not from Earth. And the other thing that was confirmed by David Grush, was that we are in possession of crashed objects and beings or sentient beings that were recovered from these crashes. Those two things right there are pretty astounding.
Yes.
And I think that made a good step forward in trying to get the U.S. government to look into this further and get some answers for the public.
Because we all know that the U.S. government is only a shadow government. It's only puppets for the people who pull the strings behind the scenes. But it's a very fact. Actually, I was told back in the late 80s or early 90s, my star people told me that your government specifically had been told that they had to release information about extraterrestrial life to humanity within a certain period, or the choice would be taken out of their hands.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Did they say which period they had to do this?
No. No, they didn't. But they said to me that humanity had to reach a certain point where there are enough people, I use the term awake, but questioning reality, questioning the government, questioning what's going on. Enough people had to be at a level of awakeness before things could progress. And we reached that level about 3.5-4 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time, things have exponentially increased. The government, instead of drip, 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 has been turning on the faucet. And they've been using social manipulation, which they're very good at, to indoctrinate humanity. It's gone from ridiculing people who are witnesses, belittling them, making it appear like they're crazy, especially in news coverage, to treating it seriously.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I think there, I don't know if you feel this, but there seems to be more and more sightings by individuals and individuals wanting to come forward, more video, more photographs coming out. That activity seems to be increasing.
I agree. They're making the presence more and more known, which is one of the reasons why I feel your government is really pushing and allowing this hearing to go ahead.
Yes. And not only in the House of Representatives, but the U.S. Senate has now adopted an amendment to the National Defense Act that's going to be approved later this year. to require agencies to produce whatever they have on the subject.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes.
Do you feel, Robert, that basically they've given disclosure with this first hearing by Koresh stating what he stated, even though he said a lot of it out of public hearing to them privately? And he has the dates, he has the places where these things are stored, and he's passed all that information on, not in the public hearing, but when he met with them privately. I tend to have this feeling that, well, obviously they're prepping the masses. But
I think these beings are intelligent enough, much more intelligent than we are.
Oh, absolutely.
To realize that our governments are not really the issue. Our governments, like you say, either politically oriented towards what they think the public wants to hear. For example, right now, I think a lot of senators and congressmen in the United States are trying to avoid this subject as much as they can. I don't think ET has plans for showing up with our president, for example, at a news conference. I think what's going to happen is that the public, the masses, are going to keep growing as to the numbers that actually believe that we are being visited by extraterrestrial beings, civilizations. And they're going to demand disclosure from the government, from their elected officials. It's already happening in other parts of the world. I just found out in Brazil, the Brazilian Senate is more interested. They're asking questions now of some of the witnesses. And I think disclosure or acknowledgement, full acknowledgement by governments will evolve eventually from that fact. And then sometime in the future, maybe the long term, extraterrestrial, let's say, ambassadors will have more contact, but that will come after the masses, the populace of our civilization has pretty well accepted that they're out there.
Well, you know, that's interesting because some years ago, when I first started this podcast, there had been a survey done amongst the American population, only the American population. And at that stage, over 60% of people believed in extraterrestrial existence. So I have no doubt since that was done, the numbers increased quite a bit.
Yeah. And if our government will have open hearings, more open hearings, like the one they had recently with the House, if the Senate has more open hearings, but now with actual witnesses like myself.
Yeah.
And others that start talking about the range of incidents that have occurred, in fact, and the public hears that from credible witnesses, that number is going to people that really believe in this. The truth of this is going to rise exponentially. And the U.S. is the key. I hate to put it that way, but because the U.S. has been kind of in the lead on the secrecy angle of this worldwide, once the U.S. admits to the fact, then the rest of the world will follow.
Yeah.
Other nations will follow.
Yeah. Sure. I agree. The US that's been holding up the works. Other countries have been willing to come forward, but it's been controlled by your government, I hate to say. Well, the powers behind your government. Is there any specific message or lesson that you'd like to convey from your experiences and those that you've come in contact with since being so open and transparent?
Well, I would like to say I'm inclined to the opinion that these beings, these extraterrestrial civilizations that are visiting, are here to try to get us humans to evolve to a better state where we are more in control of our destiny, especially with respect to things like nuclear weapons that could be used to completely destroy most living things on Earth if we were to engage in nuclear war. So that's my main, I guess, subject area in this field. I'd like to see us evolve to the point where we're back on the road to abolishing all nuclear weapons. But in order to do that, humanity must work together. All nations must work together to accomplish that, as we must work together to find solutions for global warming, which is also a way we might go extinct. So I think ET does not want to sink, and they're trying to help us.
For the most part, yeah. Because ETs, the star people races, it's like humans. There are benevolent ones and ones that want to assist us. There are ones that are neutral and just observe. And then there are malevolent ones who want to keep humanity as we currently are. But before we go, would you like to let people know the names of your books and where they can contact you if they would like to reach out to it?
Yes, actually, you can go to my website, spiralgalaxy.org, and I've got a place there where you can order my books. I'll sign them, send them to you. And I think there's a way you can contact me. I think I've got an email on my website called Keptycho, Keptycho, at spiralgalaxy.org. You can write to me there.
Thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed my conversation with you. And thank you so much for sharing and being so brave and speaking out and organizing events where people could speak out. I appreciate all the work that you're doing. And from my heart, I thank you.
Well, thank you, Marianne, for inviting me. I surely enjoyed speaking with you. I've been very comfortable talking to you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, what an incredible journey we've been on today with Robert Zelaz. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your remarkable experiences and insights with us. Your stories have truly opened our minds to the mysteries of the universe and the profound impact they have on our lives. And to you, our amazing listeners, thank you for tuning in and joining us on this adventure. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode as much as we have. If you enjoyed this episode and indeed this podcast, then consider becoming a supporter and helping me with the running costs of keeping this podcast on the air. You can buy me a coffee at www.buymeacoffee.com/walkingtheshadowlands or become a monthly supporter. Any help, big or small, is appreciated as the costs of production are becoming a little more than I can handle by myself. Don't forget to share this episode with friends. And so you don't miss out on any episode, like and follow for teasers of our upcoming shows. Also, follow us on the social media platforms. Check out our Facebook page, WET Shadowlands, our Instagram feed, Walking the Shadowlands, TikTok, Walking_the_Shadowman. Also, we have a YouTube channel under Walking the Shadowlands as well. This podcast is available on all pre-podcasting platforms. Also, if you have Alexa, say these four words, open Walking the Shadowlands, and Alexa will play our latest episode. If you don't have a smartphone, don't worry. You can listen to the episodes from the podcast website, www.walkingtheshadowlands.com. For those hearing impaired, there's a full written transcript of each episode on the website, so you don't miss out at all. Until next time. This is Marianne bidding you farewell from the Shadowlands. Thanks for listening to this episode. Ka kite.